This is the BBC.
Welcome to the Westminster Hour with me, Carolyn Quinn. In Budget Week, Philip Hammond's very last spring blast. The Chancellor said he's scrapping the earlier budget to concentrate on one big statement in the autumn. He's already made clear there'll be no spending sprees. He wants reserves in the tank, he says. Whitehall departments are on notice to find cuts of up to 6% to begin taking effect in just over 2 years' time. That's just as the UK is expected to leave the European Union. So do we greet Wednesday's statement with optimism, pessimism, or something somewhere between the two? Let's take the temperature with my panel tonight. Welcome Labour's Diane Abbott, the Shadow Home Secretary, who this year celebrates 30 years as MP for Hackney North and Stoke Newington. Celebrations later in the year, no doubt. The Conservative Kit Malthouse has a bit of catching up to do. He's been an MP for Basingstoke since 2015. Although
Northwest Hampshire.
So ah, OK. You did serve your time as Deputy London Mayor under Boris Johnson on the London Assembly. And also with us is Nicola Horlick, the businesswoman, investment fund manager, who joined the Liberal Democrats last year, inspired by their support for remaining in the EU. Welcome, all of you. And we are going to move on and talk to George Parker, the political editor of the Financial Times, who's here with us in a moment about the budget. But just seeing that Jeremy Corbyn's published his tax return, Philip Hammond this morning was adamant that he wasn't going to. He doesn't seem inclined to follow Jeremy Corbyn's lead. Would you, Diane?
Well, I would always normally follow Jeremy Corbyn's lead, but I think we're going to have to discuss this as a shadow cabinet if we're all going to publish our tax returns. But I mean, the point is, it's to illustrate the policy that we're putting forward, that people that earn over a million, I think, should publish their tax returns.
But would you publish yours?
If that's what we agree to do, certainly I'll do it.
Try and get it right, because he doesn't seem to have included the £40,000 extra he gets as Labour leader, apparently, at the moment. So the behind the scenes...
he couldn't possibly be intending to deceive anybody.
Okay. Kipps, Malthouse, would you publish yours?
No, I wouldn't. I do think there should be some limits on the privacy that politicians are entitled to, and I think that's one of them. We have a tradition in this country of people's tax affairs being confidential, and interestingly, the Inland Revenue is one of the public bodies which is the least likely to leak or reveal people's details, and I think that's a great principle to stick to.
It's a good principle, but the real issue, isn't it, is tax evasion. And there was a really interesting story, I think it was in the FT, about how the majority of these really expensive houses in London are actually owned by offshore companies and being used to launder tax. And I think people want to know more and shine a light on tax evasion. And that's the notion of, for very rich people, making their tax returns public.
How often have we heard governments or MPs talk about tackling tax evasion? Nicola Horlick, you'll have heard it a lot over your career as well. You're the non-politician here. Nobody's asking you to publish yours, but do you think it's a good idea in principle?
I think I agree with Kit that it's something that probably should remain private. And I think HMRC's done a pretty good job at blocking all the loopholes over the last few years, and a lot of budgets have tightened up on this type of thing as well. And the thing is, if people from overseas are doing something, they're not going to be filling in a UK tax return anyway, so I'm not sure that you can necessarily find that out. But I think, yeah, if you're in the public eye, there's always going to be scrutiny at a higher level, but maybe publishing your tax returns going a bit too far.
Well, if Nicola says they've blocked all the tax loopholes, then she must be right, because she would know about these sorts of things. I still think that transparency and cracking down on tax evasion is a good thing.
All right, let's move on to bring in George Parker, political editor of the Financial Times. And you, George, you've been talking to lots of people in the know, and you, like us, have been listening to the Chancellor giving interviews this morning. Now, what's your take out from what Philip Hammond's been saying so far, and give us a few headline points to look towards for the budget on Wednesday?
Well, there's been some good news around for the Chancellor in the last few weeks. Growth is going to be better than was forecast. Tax receipts are better than forecast, but I don't expect Philip Hammond to be dispensing cheer and goodwill at the dispatch box on Wednesday. Rather the opposite. He said that people are advocating that he uses some of this extra money to go on a spending spree on health or social care, whatever it should be, are reckless. So I expect the budget will be, as they say in the Treasury, fiscally neutral, which means any extra spending he does come up with on social care business rates relief will have to be offset by tax rises elsewhere.
What is the state of the public finances? Because, I mean, you mentioned there that they're a bit healthier than they were. Remember last November in the autumn statement, the Office for Budget Responsibility suggested that the Chancellor would have to borrow an extra £60 billion to cope with the rigours of Brexit. Is that still the case?
Well, basically what he's done is he's built up a war chest or contingency fund of about £27 billion for the last year of this Parliament to deal with the possibility that Brexit goes wrong. Now, obviously, he's hoping against hope that it won't go wrong. But nevertheless, that money is there. If it goes right, that money, of course, would be transformed into a handy election war chest, money that he can then start handing out in election year while still meeting his fiscal rules.
But when we hear about headroom, that's the £27 billion.
Yeah, so he's already got £27 billion booked in for the last year of the Parliament, and we're expecting in this spring budget that he's going to pump that contingency fund up even more, partly because he's worried that once the Brexit negotiations start, things could get a bit lumpy in the markets. You know, the moment it starts to look like maybe there won't be a deal, maybe Britain could crash out without an agreement, the markets could get very concerned, investment could slow down. And at that point, you might need to pump more money into the economy. So that's what he's saying, that a prudent budget, preparing for the worst, but hoping for the best.
Well, you mentioned social care, and he was criticised heavily last time in November for saying nothing about social care. He was hinting on the Andrew Marr programme this morning, though, that the government is ready to take another look at this issue.
We know that we are an ageing society, so the demands of social care for the elderly are going to get greater in the future. And yes, there's a very good case for taking a strategic look in the round at how we deal with this problem over the longer term.
Well, Kit Malthouse, criticism last time. Are you confident he will do something this time? We've seen reports, haven't we, that he'll be announcing an emergency cash injection of £1.3 billion to help with social care costs?
Yeah, I have no better intelligence than you, but the number seems remarkably precise, which leads me to believe that there have been conversations around that. I mean, look, you know, the Conservative Parliamentary Party recognises that social care is under stress at the moment, not least in combination with the problems that the health service are having. So some extra cash to get us through those issues is going to be key. But I think one of the things he said he is going to kick off is this big review of social care, what we should do to pay for this demographic problem that we've got that's not going to just trouble us for the next 2 or 3 years, but trouble us for the next 3 or 4 decades.
Mm. And what we're going to do about... Another review? How many reviews have there been so far?
We've had reviews. It's about finding the money. And the Tories will make a huge mistake if they think they can kick this into the long grass with a review. Because, you know, the cuts they've made to welfare, they've been able to get away with because they calculate, rather brutally, but they do calculate, those people aren't voting Tory anyway. But the issue of social care is a very real issue for the demographic of people that do vote Tory, whose votes they do rely on. So they have to find the money.
Diane, today we heard John McDonnell saying that the NHS needed, between £8 and £12 billion extra. Where does Labour find the money?
Well, we're looking at reversing the cuts in corporation tax.
Doesn't bring in that much.
It'll bring in, we believe, that reversing a set of cuts in corporation and inheritance tax and capital gains tax, we can bring in £70 billion. But we're also looking in the long term about how we fix the funding gap in NHS and social care. And as I say, the Tories will make a big political mistake if they don't.
£70 billion from those two, is that possible?
Three.
No,
three.
The maths don't. As Diane just said, she said they're thinking about the long term of social care, and that's fundamentally what I think we all have to do.
I think we've got to think about it immediately, because what is happening, as people age, they and their families are getting frightened about how they will manage.
Everybody's saying that it's an immediate problem. We know the problem, it's the solution we're looking for.
Well, that's the point, right? So some... immediate relief would be welcome, I think, by the social care system. Some longer-term thinking about what it looks like. If Diane wants to put in a submission to the review that says should pump all these taxes, then great.
That's very kind of you.
But there are other ways to do it.
You know who wants to know what's happening? Tory councils. They're the ones making the most noise, and have done for some years, about the crisis in social care.
Nicola Horlick.
Well, I think it is a problem that needs to be fixed very quickly. I've been on an NHS board for 9 years. I've just come off that board. And in the last 2 years, things have got dramatically worse for hospitals because beds are being blocked by frail elderly people who, in theory, are medically fit to go home but can't because there isn't anybody to look after them when they get home. And they need care in the community. They need care bed, you know, care homes. And so social care is a huge issue and it is creating massive problems for the NHS that we haven't addressed this problem. What's so disappointing about all of this is at the beginning of the coalition, there was a lot of noise being made about social care and something was apparently going to be done about it. And then somehow the Liberal Democrats and the Tories couldn't agree on what and it got kicked into the long grass. And we can't have that happening again. It is crucial that something happens now.
You're on the Treasury Select Committee. There has been speculation about reviving this idea of a death tax. Labour's Andy Burnham suggested it originally. There's some thinking about that now, isn't there, again?
Well, it was denied on the floor of the House at Treasury Questions just this week that the Treasury were looking at
it. It's always ways around words,
but,
though.
But no, they said the answer to the question was no when they were asked if they were thinking about it. It was a one-word answer, rare in the House of Commons, but
it would
clear,
be extraordinary,
nonetheless.
Though. You were so abusive to us when we talked about that type of taxation.
Exactly, which is why they said no.
What do you think, George?
Can I just make this point right? So social care does sit at the heart of a conundrum that the Chancellor faces, right, which is we have a structural deficit in this country caused by welfare, public sector pensions, debt interest, and the health service. And these are the big areas that we need to think about. If the balance between taxing our economy, as Diane wants to do, to the extent that it dampens growth, which does nothing to help solve that structural problem, but at the same time dealing with some of those temporary expenditure issues or short-term expenditure issues in a sensible way. Now, that takes some long-term thinking. Personally, I welcome the fact that the Chancellor is thinking not to the next election, but beyond, looking at some of those maybe cross-party solutions to these problems. Who knows?
George Parker.
Well, I think we're right to be sceptical about another review into social care, and I can think of at least three in the last 10 years, which haven't really amounted to very much. But I think what is true is that Philip Hammond and Theresa May see this as one of the big, probably their number one domestic policy challenge between now and the election. Leaving aside Brexit, they see this as a moment to grasp the nettle. They've got a fairly clear view to the next election. At the moment, the Labour Party is not on the field as an opposition, and they probably think this is the moment to do this. I think the big question is whether you ask people to pay for their social care while they're alive, essentially through social insurance schemes or top-ups or whatever it is, or a cap, or, as it was just somewhat there, the idea of death cuts, where you have some sort of levy on people's estates when they die. And I think there are some people around government circles who think, in the interests of intergenerational fairness and wealth not necessarily cascading through the generations and passing on privilege from one generation to the next, maybe that's the place to look.
Well, what about this as a suggestion for getting some more money into the NHS, into social care? It's a suggestion made by Rebecca Long-Bailey, the Shadow Business Secretary, today. She was talking to John Pienaar and she suggested that some dedicated money from taxation might be the answer.
People are so proud of their NHS and social care system that I don't think many people would argue with paying an extra pound or, you know, however much to ensure that we actually have an NHS. If the NHS is on the edge of a cliff and the government has no money whatsoever, then yes, I think public support would be there to keep the NHS.
Diana, across the board, tax rise to pay for the NHS? How would the lowest paid, you know, those that
you mean,
Labour has championed?
Do you mean hypothecated?
Yes.
Well, we all know the Treasury hates hypothecated taxation. Our Treasury Select Committee colleague will tell us that. You know, I can remember knocking on doors during the 1992 election campaign for Labour. I'm the only person around this table that did that. And I remember when we announced our big sort of taxation proposals, literally the atmosphere on the doorstep changed. And I had people who I knew for a fact didn't pay any tax complaining to me about proposed tax rises.
So with respect, Rebecca Long-Bailey has got it wrong on this one.
No,
saying
I'm
that
not,
people would happily
no,
pay
no,
a bit more
no,
for the
but
NHS.
Those of us that remember the 1992 campaign, and a number of us in the Labour leadership do remember it, are cautious about the question of putting up tax.
But that's exactly what she said.
I know, and it's important that we consider all the options. I just say that if you went through 1992 knocking on doors to the Labour Party, you're cautious.
Note to Rebecca Long-Bailey, maybe get a bit more experience then before you say these things.
No, I think we have to, these are such important issues. We have to explore all of the options, but we also have to draw on our historic memory as well.
Nicola, the Lib Dems liked the idea of hypothecation once, didn't they? So what about it?
Well, yeah, I think
the
Lib Dems think it's a good idea to increase tax to pay for these things. But actually, I think saving, having some incentive to save, is a good idea. I think someone somewhere mentioned ISAs as a possible way of dealing with care needs, and having an ISA that would create your own pot, and encouraging people through tax relief to save is a good idea.
Yes, but Nicola, what happens to people that can't afford to save? That's the problem.
Well, they would get free care.
You're talking about many of my constituents.
No,
they can't afford.
No, well, those people would get free care. But what I'm saying is, rather than just giving free care to everybody, try and encourage those people who can afford to save to save in order to pay for it.
Just very quickly on the point Diane made, it was absolutely correct. The Treasury hates this idea of hypothecated or earmarking taxes for specific purposes. It was quite interesting. The other day, Sir Nicholas McPherson, Lord McPherson now, the former permanent secretary of the Treasury for 10 years, wrote an article where he said that maybe the situation in the health service has got so bad now that we do need to have some kind of hypothecation so that people can understand the trade-offs between higher taxes and what you're actually paying for. So it's interesting that even people right at the top of the Treasury are starting to look at this.
So again, even the Treasury is changing its mind. Maybe Rebecca is right, after all.
You never know.
It doesn't work there anymore, let's be clear.
That is fair. He's not working there last year.
A quick word to you, Kit, about the business rates row. Mm. Now, obviously, Philip Hammond is under great pressure to do something to soften this cliff edge, soften the blow. Is he going to?
Well, again, it looks the papers have got some intelligence that he might be going to. I certainly hope he does. I mean, we're struggling with a tax designed, I think, in 1572 in an internet age, right? And the nature of business has changed. Business rates, the Treasury loves it because it's really easy to collect. They have very, very high collection rates. Properties don't disappear overseas, go bust. You know, the rates are there to be collected, so they love it. But nevertheless, it has some serious side effects.
You've got winners and losers, haven't you?
You do. And in my constituency, I have particular losers who've invested in their properties, built up a business.
So is he going to help them?
I hope so. I've no idea. He hasn't been to see me about it, but certainly...
Come on, you're on the Treasury Select Committee.
So fingers crossed. No, we're the last people, he tells. But no, I certainly hope so. And it looks like he will. He's certainly, in conversations with ministers, they recognise that there are issues with the transition on the business, the change in business rates valuation. I have to look at it. But one of the things that might be interesting coming out of the budget and out of this row about business rates is he may well kick off, sorry to say it, another review.
Oh, another review.
But looking at the nature of how we tax business, because when you've got businesses who are operating in the UK from overseas, who aren't paying that much tax, when businesses are operating without premises at all, and with very, very small numbers of employees compared to very large turnover, there is a question to be asked about how, in the next couple of decades, we start to tax, particularly international business. And maybe now is the time to think about that too.
All right, let's look ahead now to the other big event in Parliament this week, because the night before the budget comes the next crunch moment in the row between the Lords and the government over its EU withdrawal bill. Last week, peers voted, you'll remember, to amend the legislation to force the Prime Minister to guarantee the rights of EU citizens rather than use them as bargaining chips in negotiations. This Tuesday, the government's expected to suffer a second defeat over demands that MPs get a meaningful vote on Theresa May's final deal with Brussels. We'll be talking about that more in a moment. Now, on that issue of EU nationals living in the UK, more pressure on the government today from the Commons Committee on exiting the EU. Its members, they're a mixture of parties, a mixture of Remainers and Leavers. They're all urging the Prime Minister to decide unilaterally to let the 3 million EU nationals stay. They say that it's unconscionable to delay a decision until the Brexit negotiations end. But what about those at the other end of the telescope, about 1 million UK citizens who've made a life for themselves in the EU? What are their concerns about life after Brexit?
My name's Gillian Pathé-Jones. I'm a graphic artist. I'm not far off retiring age. We moved to France 13 years ago. And about 11 years ago, we persuaded my mother to come and live with us. She's 89. She's housebound and has diabetes. My mother's very well looked after in France. There's a nurse that visits daily. If we did have to leave France, the difficulties we'd have selling houses, because the market's very flat here, whether we'd be able to afford anywhere back in the UK, and how we'd get my mother home, because she can't even get into a car anymore.
My name's Robert Harrison. I've living in Munich, Germany, and I have lived down here for 25 years. About 10 years ago, I set up my own consultancy business, advising companies in Germany, but also around other countries in the European Union. I'll no longer have those rights to work. I'll no longer have the rights to stay in these countries, at least without getting a special permission to do so. For me in Germany, that's not going to be a problem. My wife is German. I've got kids who are both UK and German nationals, and I'll certainly be able to get a residence permit here, permanent residency, as well as a working permit. But what does that mean for my job outside of Germany, for the Austrian companies that I'm working with or the French companies that I'm working with?
My name's Richard Palmain. I'm originally from Hull. And about 12 years ago, myself and my partner, we decided to move to Barcelona. We're very happy here. I've got my job and my children in Catalan schools. It's this big question mark sort of hanging over our heads because we don't know what will happen. So we're currently looking into applying for Spanish citizenship. But that's not quite as easy as it seems, because if we apply to be Spanish citizens, the Spanish government doesn't recognise dual nationality. So that will mean we'll have to renounce our British citizenship, which will have lots of implications. Also, I feel like I'm restricting the choices of my children. Maybe in the future they might like to go and live in the UK. So there are a lot of question marks, I think, that need to be answered.
Diane, there are question marks for both sides of this. And do you see any hope that your colleagues, the Conservative colleagues as well, on that Brexit committee, in saying, just agree it now? Do you think those words will get through to the Prime Minister?
Well, I hope so. I mean, those were very interesting stories we just heard. But all of the organisations that represent British people living in the EU say that the British government should decide on EU citizens unilaterally. And it's not just a human rights issue and the uncertainty. It's also a problem for business in the public sector. I'm speaking to people in education, I'm speaking to people in the health service, and the applications from EU nationals are going down, and also EU nationals they currently employ are thinking about going. This uncertainty is bad for people, but it's also bad for business.
The government here say it's the EU that are stalling, that there are or two countries who are blocking
things. They could
things.
Agree this unilaterally. What are they really going to do?
Nicola,
deport all those EU nationals?
Nicola Hawlett, you're agreeing with that.
Yes,
on
I
that
agree
point,
with Diane. Yep.
That really it's time to just say whatever happens to UK people living in the EU, let's agree at least on the EU nationals here.
Yeah, because it has major implications.
But do you leave those people, that million people, floating in the wind?
I'm not saying that we should forget about them or not fight for them, but I think there's no one preventing us from saying we want the EU nationals who are here now, who want to stay, to stay. And it affects three areas, particularly finance, my industry. It affects that enormously. There are a lot of European nationals working here in London in the finance sector, the NHS and academia. A lot of people working in universities have expressed a real concern about this.
Kit Malthouse, the cross-party Brexit committee say just do something now, don't wait for a reciprocal deal. Why not?
Well, I agree with them. I have to say, my strong view has been right from the start that we should say that the e-nationals should be able to stay, although it's more complicated than it first appears. There are some wrinkles. What do we do about EU national prisoners? Do we mean everybody who just arrived yesterday, or are we saying there's a five-year limit? And there seems to be some confusion, whether by accident or design. I mean, what the government have said is that the normal rules apply. If you've been here for longer than 5 years, and that's about 60% of EU nationals, then you have the right to stay whatever happens. By the time we get to Brexit in 2 years' time, that will be over 90% of people who are here on referendum day. So for all of them, in theory, it shouldn't be a problem. But the truth is, the amendment that's gone through the House of Lords doesn't do that. It doesn't protect them. All it does is say the Prime Minister has to come up with a plan within 3 months. Well, if she doesn't, what are they going to do? Lock her up? Her plan might be not to guarantee.
I don't think it's
The amendment doesn't do what everybody seems to think it's going to do, which is why I don't think it'll pass through the House of Commons. To be fair to the Prime Minister, she has said that she tried to agree a deal with EU governments, but was blocked by two or three of them before.
Was it Germany,
we got to this stage.
Germany, Poland. Do we know the
Who knows why? What we need to do now for all of those people, and Diane, we agree about the uncertainty on this, what we need to do now is allow the Prime Minister to trigger Article 50 as quickly as possible so that she can do what she said she's going to do, which is agree that deal for them up front.
But there
as
are
fast
no guarantees it will be the first but the issue.
The most important thing to bear in mind, and there will be EU nationals listening to this resident in the UK, the thing to bear in mind is that for any of them to be removed from the country, there would need to be primary legislation in the House of Commons for that to happen, and that is not going to pass.
Let's move on to the other issue that's going to come up. If peers vote on Tuesday to demand a meaningful vote on the Brexit deal, it means that MPs will have two amendments to consider when the bill returns to the Commons, probably a week tomorrow. Last time, the Tory MP for Bromley, Bob Neil, was among seven Conservatives who defied their whips and called for MPs to get a chance to vote once the shape of the negotiated deal looks clearer, rather than the take-it-or-leave-it option favoured by the Prime Minister. So if the meaningful vote issue returns, is Bob Neil minded to rebel again?
Well, I'd certainly be inclined to vote in that way unless the government is able to come up with alternative assurances on the floor of the Commons, which has the effect of saying, well, it needn't be on the face of the bill, but this is what will happen. I think the onus will be on the government, if the amendment was passed in the Lords, to say, well, why should we reverse that amendment, and what's the alternative assurance that they can put in place? Now, you know, I hope that the government is being constructive and listening on this one.
Would you trust something that wasn't on the face of the bill, though?
Well, that would depend precisely on the form of words that was used. And that's why the ball is in the government's court in that regard.
What sort of words would you look for?
Well, I've made it clear that I want something which specifies not only the timing of the vote, which I think we have got now before it goes to the European side and the European Parliament for ratification, but also want it made clear that there's a vote whether or not there is a deal or no deal. Because if there is no deal, that means that we would potentially leave the EU straight onto WTO, World Trade Organization terms, and without any transition arrangements. I believe that will be deeply damaging for this country. And I think Parliament should have the right to consider that before we go down irrevocably that path.
When MPs voted on their own amendment to this last time, you were among seven Conservative MPs who rebelled against the government.
That's right.
Do you anticipate that there will be more MPs this time joining you?
I've not been trying to tally up numbers. And after all, that was the first time in the whole of my career I'd felt the need to vote against my party on a three-line whip. Not something I did with any pleasure or lightly. But the principle is an absolutely a critical one.
And talk of 20 Conservative MPs perhaps prepared to join you if you rebel?
Well, I'll talk for myself. I've not been in the numbers counting business. I'm concerned about making the argument because it's a matter of principle as far as I'm concerned.
George Parker, what are you hearing about numbers and Conservative MPs supporting this idea?
Well, I was speaking to one of the Conservative rebels the last time this was in the House of Commons, and this MP was saying that they didn't expect there to be sufficient numbers to defeat the government on this, because to overturn the government majority, you will need 20 or probably more Conservatives to vote against the government, because the Theresa May can count on the Democratic Ulster Unionists, for example. So I think the Conservative Party whips, the government whips, are confident they can overturn this amendment, which I think will pass in the House of Lords this week when it comes back to the House of Commons.
Kit Malthouse, do you understand your colleagues like this, having these battles with their conscience and what to do?
Yeah, I mean, look, Bob Neil is a good and wise man and an old friend, but I think he happens to be incorrect on this issue. The Prime Minister's already promised a vote in the House, and presumably, if the opposition parties wanted a meaningful vote on the deal, such is the nature of it, that they'd put down a motion of no confidence in the government. That's going to be ultimately the sanction that that Parliament has. The SNP may well do that in any event, whatever way the vote goes. If that vote is lost, then we're effectively picked into a general election and the people will decide.
Diane, Labour will support the idea of an amendment on the lines of a meaningful vote.
Yeah, because we supported it last time.
But you still support Article 50 being triggered. I mean, you had that difficult moment, didn't you, on the second reading when you didn't go to vote.
Our position is that we were never going to willfully block triggering Article 50, because that would be fundamentally undemocratic.
Did you feel uncomfortable at that second reading vote? Sorry, when you didn't turn up.
What I feel uncomfortable about is the idea that we're going into a negotiation and at the end of the negotiation, the European Parliament has a vote on the deal, but the British Parliament doesn't. And I think the government should think twice about before putting the British people in that position.
There is a point, isn't there, Kit Malthouse, that people want to think that they can say to Theresa May, go back, try to get something better. They don't want a take it or leave it deal.
Yeah, it's quite hard to see how that would work with our EU negotiating partners. A Prime Minister who's sent back again to ask for a different type of deal, they've no reason to think to give her that extra deal, knowing that she has no support in the House of Commons. This is why I think, to be honest with you, in the end, the deal will be the deal, and it'll be a binary decision by Parliament whether it wants to run with that deal or not. If it doesn't, then it's a fundamental question about the government. As I say, we may well end up in a no confidence motion. But you have to bear in mind we've got a 2-year process of negotiating here, and we're dealing with a counterparty about whom we know quite little at the moment. There are various voices on the continent, whether it's in Brussels or in national governments, who are saying very, very different things. I like to hold out the hope, because I'm an idealistic Brexiteer, that we'll reach a civilised arrangement with our EU partners, which the House of Commons will be happy with. But as I say, if they're not, and the SNP, as far as I can tell, will never be happy with any deal, then the ultimate sanction is there.
Clive Lewis resigned as Shadow Business Secretary, didn't he, over this issue, saying he couldn't obey the Labour whip to support triggering Article 50.
Yeah.
You've stayed within the shadow cabinet. Now, he's insisting today he hasn't gone because he wants to stage a leadership bid. He was talking to John Pienaar on Five Live earlier, but he did say you have to keep the option open of stepping up to the plate to serve the party if it needs you. Never say never, he said. And on a scale of 1 to 100, how confident was he that Jeremy Corbyn could turn the polls around? He said 75%. Do you agree?
I'm 100% confident. But Clive Lewis...
Well, you said last December, didn't you, that you were confident Jeremy Corbyn could close the...
Within 12 months.
So
within 12 months, and I'm confident of that. And Clive Lewis, they keep kind of winding him up to say he's going to be some kind of leadership challenger. I don't think that's on his mind.
Well, he said he would be prepared to step up to the plate.
We all have. We all, as politicians, have field marshal's batons in our knapsack. That doesn't mean to say that we're about to pose a leadership challenge in our party.
Are you still going to do that Labour Heartlands tour with him, which was due to start on April the 1st? Touring marginal northern seats.
I've read about this Labour Heartlands tour, but no one has spoken to me about it. But I'm here to serve. I'm here to serve the party. Whatever they want me to do, I'll do it.
George Parker, we have some other issues, of course, the fallout from the Northern Ireland elections. Can you just briefly give us a sense of where that's going to and the build-up?
Well, it's a remarkable result there in Northern Ireland, with Sinn Féin becoming within touching distance of overtaking the DUP as the biggest party. There are now 3 weeks, basically, for the DUP and Sinn Féin to get together to try and form a power-sharing administration. If they don't do that within 3 weeks, there are two things that could happen. One is there could be another set of elections, which I'm sure is the last thing the people of Northern Ireland want. And the other alternative is a return to direct rule from Westminster, which, again, isn't a suboptimal outcome. So there's a lot of work to be done. Lots of different motives in play. Some people would argue that maybe Sinn Féin don't necessarily want to go back in with the DUP, that, you know, fuel a sense of grievance if direct rule was reinstated and all the rest of it. But I think both sides, there's been a softening of the language in recent days, and they've got 3 weeks to try and put something together.
Well, George, we will see. Obviously, keep a close watch on that story over the next few weeks. You're going to go and have a quick look at the front pages for us, and we will move on to hear the second part of our interview with Harriet Harman. You heard some of it last week. She's been prominent in British politics for 35 years. She's Britain's longest-serving woman MP. She's been a cabinet minister, served as Labour's deputy leader and then acting leader twice. From the lows of her party's general election defeats in the 1980s to the highs of the new Labour landslide, she's seen it all. And she's just published her memoirs charting her lifelong campaign for women's equality. She had no diary to prompt her, but when she became MP for Peckham in a by-election in 1982, she decided to write a report every month to her constituency committee. Those neatly typed reports, photocopied and filed, have proved a vital archive as she's written her book. And she explained to me how they came about.
Well, I never would have had time to write a diary. The idea that when I was managing, bringing up young children, being an MP, a busy constituency MP, working on the front bench, trying to get the Labour Party back into government, and that I would sit tranquilly and write my diaries. There was never going to be any time for that. But because I was having children and there weren't any other MPs with young children who were actually in the House of Commons having babies, I was concerned that people would think I would not be able to do my job properly. So I had to write down all the meetings I was going to and the things that I was pushing forward and campaigning on, because I thought if I didn't, they would just think I was sitting at home enjoying the children.
Recalling some of the things that you wrote then, and when you reread them, are you surprised at yourself and the attitude that you struck back then?
I am, in a way. When I looked at the first report I did after I'd taken my seat in the House of Commons in 1982, in the same month that I got elected, I set up the Women's PLP, the group of Labour Women MPs. And I didn't ask the Chief Whip, I didn't ask the Chair of the PLP, I didn't ask the Secretary of the PLP or the leader of the Labour Party, because they were all men. And the theory of the women's movement is you didn't, as a woman, ask men for permission to meet as women. So I organised for us to meet, and then all hell broke loose.
The reports at various points show that dilemma that you had between being a proud mum but also trying to be an MP.
Yes, this one is October 1984, where I'm about to have my second baby. And at the end of a report, which is includes items about pensioners, policing, social services, housing, the miners' dispute, post office closures, I drop in maternity leave. My baby is due in November and I'm finding it increasingly difficult to get around, but I am trying to keep up with as much work as possible from home, and I'm also hoping to make watertight arrangements to ensure that my constituency work is properly dealt with in the period after the baby is born, and to ensure that I try to maintain regular newspaper coverage on issues of local concern. When I read that, I can remember I was scarcely coping, but I kept it well hidden. I once went through the division lobby after I'd had my first child and was reported to the sergeant at arms, allegedly for taking a baby through the division lobby, reported by a Labour MP to be reprimanded. In fact, I then had to humiliatingly explain to the sergeant at arms that, of course, I hadn't been taking a baby through the division lobby. It was just that I still had the baby fat because I'd come back so soon after having given birth. And looking back on it, it was a sort of harassment.
The Labour movement wasn't women-friendly, was it, at that point? There was one particular incident involving the Fire Brigades Union that you document in your notes there.
It was not regarded as at all OK as a Labour MP to be criticising the trade unions. But here's a time when I did take issue with one of the unions, the Fire Brigades Union. And this is my report, 6th of February, 1985. Sex attack on woman fire officer. The GLC reinstated a fireman who had poured urine over a woman firefighter and exposed himself to her. They decided that the behaviour did not amount to gross misconduct justifying dismissal. I went on a delegation to see Ken Cameron, Fire Brigades Union General Secretary, to urge him and the GLC to overturn the reinstatement. The trade union movement and a progressive Labour authority cannot be seen to condone sexual attacks on female employees. Now, I was very much criticised for that because I was asking for a trade union member to be sacked, and that was absolutely anathema. So I had to write down meticulously why I was taking the protest. Nothing could be taken for granted. Everything had to be argued through, and everything was highly contested. For example, there was an editorial against me in the South London Press when I'd complained about some racist jokes in the Guy's Hospital Rag magazine.
I think we ought to put a little bit of a warning on this one, yes, because they are quite really offensive, these jokes.
But this was taken as just humour, banter. And the fact that I didn't think it was OK, and many of us didn't think it was OK, had us labelled as humourless feminists who couldn't see a joke. And this was February 1984. Guy's Hospital Rag magazine. Guy's Hospital have a charity fundraising rag week every year. This year they produced a magazine to raise money which contained racialist jokes. Examples include, how do you stop a Pakistani from spitting? Turn the grill down. And how do you get 100 Jews into a mini? One driving and 99 in the ashtrays. I've sought a meeting with the people who produced the magazine to express my disgust. I've referred the magazine to the Director of Public Prosecutions to consider prosecuting for incitement to racial hatred. The magazine has now been withdrawn. It was a time when we were challenging what was a sort of generalised acquiescence in persistent racism, persistent sexism, you know, oh, it's just the way things are. And it was a new movement which was absolutely going to be tackling discrimination. And so many of the things that we were raising then, which were a hard fight, people have now accepted were completely wrong.
Extraordinarily turbulent times for the country and for the Labour Party. You had militant breathing down your neck. How was that threat reflected in your reports?
There was a general hard left sectarianism. And in fact, within my own constituency, Labour Party, where unfortunately the Labour Club bar was in the same room where we were holding the meeting. And often fights would break out in the meeting. It was a very threatening and intimidating atmosphere. So it was a time not only of strife and turbulence within the Labour Party, but also quite a lot of racist violence and right-wing activity on the streets, which is what I refer to in my report after we lost the election in 1983.
Just give us a sense of what you were saying.
Well, this was a very controversial report because there were a lot of Labour Party members on the sectarian left who felt that 83 was a wonderful moment because we had very left-wing policies and it didn't seem to matter to them that people weren't voting for them. So I wrote this report in June 1983 called Facing the Facts. Labour nationally has just suffered a devastating defeat. We have lost many of the arguments on key areas of policy. We're now further back than at any time since 1931. Unless the party pulls itself together, we could face a similar period in the political wilderness. We will never win another election if we sit back and wait for either international capitalism to collapse or Margaret Thatcher to slip on a political banana skin. For the Tories are rewriting the political map of this country. Now, the thing about that is I never would have been able to get an article like that into The Guardian. It was really the agenda for New Labour as it became. But the political commentariat didn't engage with my political arguments because they were regarded as kind of not sort of heavyweight because I was like a ditzy pregnant woman. But banging on about childcare.
Well, you say towards the end of the book that what's happening in Labour since Jeremy Corbyn's election is a painful echo of what happened in the 1980s. Do you sometimes think that what you wrote then, you could write today?
Well, remembering what happened back then, we felt that we should be telling people what to think because people were getting it wrong and were not voting for us because they were just seriously wrong. And that if we just said with a very loud voice all the time what we thought, that somehow it would change people's mind. And we also thought that the way to defeat the Tories was to really shout terribly loudly about how bad the Tories were. But we were less popular than the Tories. And an unpopular opposition shouting at a more popular government simply increases the unpopularity of that opposition.
Did your reports continue in that kind of detail when you went into government after 97? Because you took over the Department of Social Security, you were looking into those issues, you had Frank Field installed as your deputy, and you famously got sacked within a year. Do you chart some of that in your documents here?
When I'm in government for that first 15 months in 1997, I report what I do as Minister for Women, setting up the National Childcare Strategy, making domestic violence a priority. And then once I'd been sacked, I didn't explain in the report why I'd got sacked. I didn't want them to feel that they had to go into opposition to the Labour government because their MP had been sacked. So it was like OK, we're carrying forward, I'm an MP, and this is what we're all going to be doing.
You've expressed regret that you didn't insist on being made Deputy Prime Minister when you served under Gordon Brown. And with other reflections now, do you think that you should have stood for leader yourself?
Well, I definitely think I should have insisted that Gordon Brown make me Deputy Prime Minister. And I think if it had been any other woman who'd been elected Deputy Leader, I'd be kicking down the door. But I should have actually just myself banged on the door and said, look, this is a missed opportunity. We've never had a woman Prime Minister from the Labour Party. Now we've got a chance at least to have a woman Deputy Prime Minister.
But missed opportunity, in your view, personally, that you didn't go for the leadership?
I think probably I could have got elected because it turns out that actually the party hadn't taken to David Miliband, and I was very popular with the party at that point, and Ed Miliband was largely unknown. So I think probably I would have got elected, but whether or not I would have made a better job of it than Ed Miliband, who knows? Nobody will ever know, so there's no point regretting. But it is odd that the Labour Party members were saying to me, you should go for leader, and somehow I didn't really think about it.
Here we are, Reflections with Harriet Harman. And interesting, sitting here with Nicola Horlick and with Diane Abbott. I mean, Nicola, you and your time have been talked about somebody who's managed to have it all, you know, superwoman. And yet it's still incredibly hard to be a woman in your field, isn't it?
Yeah, it is actually surprising, really. I've been in the city for 34 years in October, and there still aren't that many very senior women in financial institutions. So we haven't
glass
done
ceiling.
Terribly well.
The glass ceiling remains unbroken.
Well, I used to be in charge whenever I was doing graduate recruitment, which I did myself because I thought it was so important. I'd always make sure we had equal numbers of boys and girls coming into the business. But within 3 years, most of the women had left. And I used to do exit interviews, and they just used to say, we don't like working in the city.
And Diane, you've talked about the difficulties that you've faced, the sort of abuse that you've had on Twitter and social media, you know, racist, sexist abuse. So things have still not moved on. They may have dramatically improved since Harriet Harman was first in Parliament, but tell us your experience.
Well, they moved on a little. I was listening to Harriet and feeling a lot of sympathy. I had my son as an MP 10 years after Harriet had her children. And it was still the case. There was no maternity leave. I mean, I was in Parliament the week before I had my son, and I voted 8 days afterwards. There was no question of the whips giving you maternity leave. And I remember bringing my son on a Friday and standing in the members' lobby. I think I was going to the post office. And a Tory, who shall be nameless, looked at me and this little baby with complete horror and said to me, haven't you got a nanny? And I said, I'm afraid not. I've had to bring him in this Friday. It was a different world, actually, at the beginning of the 90s. As for the abuse, I mean, I think it's turbocharged now. And it's partly because new media makes it so much easier. It's partly, people see rubbish online and so they think they can tweet or email abuse, racist abuse themselves. But I must say, it was the death of Jo Cox which made some of us stop and think. Of course, when she died, your thoughts went to her children and her family and so on. But for someone like me, who's had the death threats in the past and thought, oh, it will never happen, suddenly you had to think, well, maybe it can happen and you should take this stuff more seriously. But it is horrible. And horrible, I must say, for my staff who have to open everything and look at everything.
Kit Morehouse, just briefly from you. Have you suffered abuse? Do you know of colleagues who have?
Well, nowhere near as much, I have to say, as the female MPs do. Talking to my colleagues in the team, it becomes clear that they get, you know, a multiple of the kind of abuse that we get, particularly through social media. And as I say, I know at least one or two who've decided to come off Twitter, Facebook because of the kind of abuse they get. Just on the maternity and babies, happily, things have changed. I think in my coming up 2 years now, I've counted 4 babies going through the lobbies, 2 in each party. So they don't get to vote, sadly, yet, but they're definitely there in numbers.
Well, let's have a minute look at the front pages, shall we, with George, because I think it's pretty obvious what's going to be on the front pages.
Well, yes, if you've been working at Westminster today, you've been trying to find out what's in the budget. And the answer is we've all been scratching around a bit. The Chancellor did his round of media interviews today. We're taking a tough line. The Times have got the idea that he's going to pay for his budget so-called giveaways, this stuff for money for social care and business rates we were talking about earlier, by putting up taxes. And they're suggesting that the self-employed and drinkers could pay a bit more. And the Daily Telegraph talking a little bit about the fact that Philip Hammond wants to make Britain the mobile web leader in the world, putting money into robots and batteries and all that sort of technology.
George, thank you very much. That is all we have time for. George Parker, Diane Abbott, Nicola Horlick, Kit Malthouse, thanks all very much. Join us again next week. Thank you for downloading this edition of the Westminster Hour with Carolyn Quinn. You can find more information about the programme on the BBC website.